This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 199, The Search for Pineapple. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Zachary Frueling. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including a new collection of the classic James Blish TOS novelizations, the results of the Strange New Worlds short story contest, and Simon Pegg's thoughts on the foundation of Star Trek. Then in the feature, we're joined by Brandon Shea Mutala and Dennis Costello to discuss the Enterprise episode, Silent Enemy. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Zachary. Welcome back to The Ready Room. It's great to have you here with me on the eve of the 200th show. I can't believe we're closing out all of the episodes numbered in the 100s already.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be back in The Ready Room. It is really exciting to see the 200th episode of The Ready Room coming up. You know, it occurred to me I was on the last episode of The Ready Room, but it was some weeks ago. It's been a while since we've done one of these.
It has been. Yeah, my new job, as I've mentioned in different places, certainly in the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook, I've told people about this, but my new job has just completely taken over all of my time recently. I think once I'm through the transition, we'll get settled in. In fact, for those wondering about The Ready Room, I have established a schedule that will keep the show at least biweekly, and it's already scheduled out through early 2017, and almost all the panel slots are already filled as well, and we have topics lined up. Three choices per episode to start, and then we'll lock those in as we go. So we are getting things back together here, getting the pieces back in place to get the Ready Room back on a regular schedule. And then, Zachary, maybe it won't feel like it's been so long, even though you were here for the last episode.
Well, I'm really excited. You know, I'm looking forward to talking about Enterprise tonight. We're going to talk about the episode Silent Enemy. And yeah, on Metatrex, the show that I host on Star Trek and Philosophy, we don't talk about Enterprise all that much. And partly that's my fault. Enterprise is not the show I'm most familiar with, but I'm excited to talk about Enterprise tonight. I've had a big dinner with my favorite food, so I've got lots of energy. I'm not going to tell you what my favorite food is, though. maybe we can make that some sort of a Trek FM contest. If anyone can guess my favorite food, I'll send you a surprise in the mail.
All right, because I thought I saw an Instagram photo that you posted tonight of a pineapple pizza.
Oh, no. It doesn't involve pineapple or any of its chemical components in any way, shape, or form.
All right, well, Reed will be very disappointed. All right, well, let's get on into some news here. We have three items that we're going to talk about in news today. And the first one here got me really excited when I first saw it, because it's about the Classic Episodes Anthology being released. And these are novelizations of 45 original series episodes. And the reason it got me really excited is because I've been waiting for the James Blish novels to be released again. Because I didn't pick up those paperbacks when I had an opportunity about 15 years ago. They had them in Tower Records here in Tokyo, in the big one in Shibuya. And I didn't pick them up. And I wish I had, because now for years I've been trying to get my hands on them. Of course, I can find them used, I can have them shipped to Japan, but the actual cost of doing that is just too much. It's not practical because those books are kind of hard to come by, and then international shipping. And so these are adaptations by James Blish as well as J.A. Lawrence, and they're being published by Barnes & Noble. Zachary, have you ever had a chance to read any of those original novelizations?
You know, I haven't, and that's one of the things that makes me really excited. You know, frankly, I've never really got into reading Star Trek novels. I've read a few. There are a couple I could point to that are some of my favorites of the few I've read. One that comes to mind is an old TNG novel, Boogeyman. I remember reading some novelizations of, say, Generations when Generations came out. But they're these one-off instances. And so I'm really excited. I think this is an incredible value. I was looking at the sheet describing this book that's coming out. You know, $25 is a price tag for all these stories, 45 stories. This is something I could pick up in one fell swoop and give me an excuse to dive in and read these novels I've never read. So I'm really excited about this one.
Yeah, I said at the beginning that I got really excited, and that implied that maybe I wasn't as excited right now. And the reason for that is that James Blish actually did novelizations of all 79, almost all episodes of the original 79, of course, The Cage being the 80th episode, which was never released until later. And they were released in 12 volumes. And this book contains 45 novelizations. And so I don't think it's the complete set of everything that James Blish did. So in that respect, I still kind of want to get those original 12 again. But this is a good way because this is only going to cost $25. And it's leather-bound hardcover, 720 pages. It is a good way to get a lot of those, including key episodes like Amok Time, The Doomsday Machine, The Trouble with Tribbles, The City on the Edge of Forever, The Menagerie, and get all those in one volume.
Chris, when were these novelizations done originally? When did they start?
They were done in the 60s. So the first one was published in 67, January 67, actually. So right, you know, when the show was on. And the second one was in February 68, and then roughly one per year after that. Although in 72, he really went on a tear and put out four volumes. And then it was basically one per year again after that, until November of 77, which is when the last one came out. So pretty much the whole decade, really, I mean, from the end of the 60s to the end of the 70s, fans were getting these novelizations by James Blish and J.A. Lawrence.
And you listeners at home can't see this in front of you, but we're looking at it on the screen here. We can see the cover of this novel. It's a beautiful book. You know, this is a novel. I think even if you're not a Star Trek fan, if you're walking around Barnes & Noble, you'll see this cover. It'll jump out at you. It screams Star Trek. And, you know, here we are in 2016, the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. And so this is a perfect way to get, I mean, any press surrounding Star Trek on its 50th anniversary is good for the franchise. And I hope this brings in some new readers, but viewers of the franchise and the new movie and the new TV show that's around the corner. This can only be a good thing for the franchise.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of books coming out surrounding the 50th, which is great. That's, you know, that's something that, I mean, there are a lot of different types of merchandise coming around surrounding the 50th. Books I particularly like because they often give you that inside look to the series, and it's a way that you can really celebrate the history more so than you can do on other types of merchandise. So I'm glad to see this. It's part of, and I'm not familiar with this because I live in Japan, so I cannot go into a Barnes & Noble and see what they're doing, but they have something called the Collection Editions series, and this is going to be part of that series. So if you know what that is, then you might already have an idea of what this might look like. There's a quote in the article on StarTrek.com about this story from Barnes & Noble. And what they said about it is that our editorial team had been wanting for some time to add a Star Trek-themed title to our collectible editions line. And when we realized that 2016 would mark the 50th anniversary of the original Star Trek television series, we saw a golden opportunity. The book's editor remembered reading as a teenager the 12 Star Trek collections published between 1967 and 1977, for which science fiction writer James Blish adapted the scripts for all of the episodes from the original series as short stories. And again, I don't think that he did all of them, but he did most of them. Working with our partners at Penguin Random House, who published the original story collections, we chose the 45 episodes that we thought Star Trek fans would instantly recognize as classics: The Menagerie and The City on the Edge of Forever, both of whose scripts won science fiction's prestigious Hugo Award, The Trouble with Tribbles, The Doomsday Machine, and episodes that had originally been scripted by Harlan Ellison, Robert Block, Richard Matheson, Theodore Sturgeon, Norman Spinrad, David Gerrold, and other leading science fiction writers. CBS generously provided our design team with the artwork that adorns the book's bonded leather case and production stills of the cast and the USS Enterprise that we use for end papers. The result is a book that we hope will thrill Star Trek fans and pay tribute to a landmark of our popular culture. So that's the thought process behind this. I'm glad that they realized that 2016 would mark the 50th anniversary, Zachary.
Well, it's been a little quiet on the 50th anniversary front. I mean, I know there's some big things happening with the movie coming and the TV show and whatnot, but it's getting nowhere near the attention that Star Wars is getting. So I've been a little disappointed. I'm glad to see that finally some new materials and new products and new fanfare are starting to reveal itself as we're creeping into the 50th anniversary.
Yeah, bit by bit, for sure. All right, so that is good to see. Moving on to the next story. This is about Star Trek Beyond. We talked a little bit about this on past shows. Of course, we've talked about the fallout, shall I say, from the Star Trek Beyond trailer. And you had Simon Pegg coming out trying to do damage control. You had Justin Lin coming out trying to do damage control. And a lot of people are questioning whether, well, they've always questioned really whether J.J. Abrams and Bad Robot understands Star Trek when they're making these movies. And I think that that initial trailer that we saw did not do anything to make anyone feel more comfortable. And a lot of people see Justin Lin only as the Fast and Furious franchise, even though he has, of course, done other things. And even those movies, a lot of people will tell me, have a family component to them that lends itself well to Star Trek. So anyway, in an interview with Collider, Simon Pegg talked about Star Trek, and he talked about the trailer and other aspects of it and what they're doing. And there's a story about that on TrekNews.net that we're going to quote from a little bit here. And the thing is that he talks about the foundation of Star Trek as being something that we have to hang on to. So Zachary, I want to share with you this excerpt, and then I want to get your thoughts on how this applies to Beyond and maybe even the new series. So this is just one part, by the way. If you go to TrekNews.net, there are a lot of different excerpts from that interview, and I've just pulled out this one specific one that I want to talk about. So this is what he said. It was pointed out that a challenge that both Star Trek 2009 and Into Darkness attempted to overcome was appealing to both hardcore Trekkies and general movie-going audiences, which, of course, that's what the studio wants, right? They need a film to encompass everyone in order to make the money that they're trying to make. Satisfying both groups can be an incredible challenge, and the two previous films have received an amount of criticism for being too candy-coated and action-heavy by the Star Trek fan base. So Pegg addressed this, and he said that being given the keys to the Star Trek universe was an extraordinary privilege. It was extremely important to me that we did it justice. I know Star Trek means a lot to a lot of different people. It means an enormous amount to some people. And at the same time, it should be something that everyone can enjoy as well. So you have to look at the means of writing a screenplay as well, which is an invitation to the uninducted, he says, of the Federation Fan Club. And he says that as if it's an actual organization that you can sign up for.
It sounds like a choice word, uninducted. I mean,
I know, uninducted like a very carefully of the Federation word. Fan Club, right? But he goes on and he says, those who have been watching the show for 50 years and knowing it and loving every element of it. And also what's available to us now and the state of cinema now and the spectacle to bring people in. It was, let's combine it. Let's combine the philosophies and the tenets of the Star Trek universe with bigger set pieces and exciting stuff. Let's see Kirk and the guys doing stuff we haven't seen them do before, like riding motorcycles. I inserted that myself. Simon Pegg did not say that. Because just to be clear, we just literally haven't been able to do that. But that's not at the expense of the other stuff. Star Trek is a very thoughtful story. It's a very intelligent, hopeful projection of our own futures, and that's something we have to hang on to. Okay, so that's the part I exerted, Zachary. So what are your thoughts on that? And not only how Simon Pegg is seeing that, because he wrote Beyond, but just how that applies to telling Star Trek stories, whether it's these films or the new series.
You know, I think there's a lot going on here. It says to me that it's really, really difficult to come up with something in Star Trek that, you know, has the best of everything you expect. You know, it should be an interesting story. It should be some science fiction. It should have some philosophy in it. It needs to have character development. You can go on and on and on. And there's a long list of things that good Star Trek seems to do very naturally when it's done at its best. So I think it's a balancing act. I mean, the worst thing you could do is take all these elements and smush them together in a way that doesn't make sense, right? So you hope that these elements are combined in some sort of coherent way. But it's the end of the quote that really appeals to me, the notion that Star Trek is a hopeful projection of our own futures. And, you know, without a doubt, Star Trek always has social commentary. You can find it in Star Trek 2009. You can find it even in Star Trek Into Darkness, which is not a fan favorite for a lot of people. In fact, recently we did an episode of Metatrex where we talked about Star Trek Into Darkness and tried to bring out some of the deeper elements that are hidden inside that movie. But I think the thing that concerns me is there's a very fine line to walk. What I'm trying to say is there's a danger that social commentary can devolve into cynicism, you know, and Star Trek has this hopeful optimism about a better future for ourselves and our place in the universe, that if you don't hold on to that optimism, you can put in all the social commentary and philosophy you want, but it comes across as cynical commentary on the state of humankind. Because without a doubt, Star Trek shines the mirror back at ourselves and makes us see both our virtues and our failings. And we want to, you know, take those failings and realize, you know, there's a way to overcome those failings and see the better parts of ourselves. And Star Trek has always held on to that. And if you don't latch on to that optimism, you know, like kicking and screaming, like I'm going to hold on to it no matter what, you lose what in my mind is just the very soul of Star Trek. You know, you can have any one of these elements missing and still have good Star Trek. But if you don't have that optimism, that's like a core, crucial, necessary element to me.
And so did you feel that the optimism was missing from Into Darkness?
You know,
I think that's the general feeling, but then I hear some people who will point out that that's not necessarily the case.
That's a hard question. I didn't read it as a terribly optimistic movie. I found it a relevant movie. The question of how far we're willing to go to protect ourselves in this dangerous world that we live in is a very relevant question, and Star Trek Into Darkness deals with that head on. I'm not sure I found it the most optimistic movie. So I think, you know, to change the subject just a little bit, what I loved about what I've seen of the Star Trek Beyond trailer so far, I haven't been one of the haters. You know, I want to see as much philosophy in there as the next guy, obviously, as host of Metatrek, Star Trek, and philosophy, right? I want the philosophy in there. But I do want to see those characters do something new and different that I haven't seen them before. I want them to bond together in ways that really connect them together as a team, like we saw the original cast members in the original Star Trek. I want to see those things. And, you know, if I have to sacrifice a little bit of philosophy for that, I can live with that. So yeah, I haven't been a terrible hater of the J.J. Abrams, you know, Star Trek 2009 and Into Darkness, yeah, and now Beyond movies.
Well, I liked 2009 better than Into Darkness. I think part of the problem, though, is that if you look at Into Darkness and what they did in that film, it has a lot of similarities with Deep Space Nine, mm-hmm, which is my favorite of the series. DS9 has a lot of darkness to its storyline. But I would argue that underlying all of that is an optimism that we come together, we overcome, and that we fight to protect the values that are important to us.
Well, it's adult Star Trek. I mean, you know, part of being an adult in the real world is having a sense of ideals and who you are and having those challenged from outside by situations or circumstances,
or acknowledging troubles. The fact that they will be challenged, right? You don't create a better future and then it's just there and it's just stagnant and nothing ever threatens it, right? That's not reality.
Yeah, you'd end up with Star Trek The Next Generation if you did that, right? No,
right, well, exactly. And I think that's why a lot of people who love The Next Generation don't like Deep Space Nine, because Deep Space Nine challenges that premise. But in the end, our heroes protect it, right? They fight to maintain that vision of the future that Gene Roddenberry wanted.
And, you know, for me, the newer Star Trek movies, they're, it's almost a question of tone, you know, rather than content. I mean, yes, you can find philosophical issues and you can talk about character development and whatnot. But there are moments inside Star Trek 2009 that inspire me, you know, like at the end of the movie when they're all on the bridge and they're ready to warp off into space. You know, that's inspiring. It just speaks. It's a metaphor for the possibilities of existence. And yeah. That speaks to me in volume. So, you know, as long as there's something, you know, at its core, optimistic and inspiring, you know, I'm very flexible about what kinds of issues they deal with in what way and, you know, what kinds of stories and whatnot. So I'm optimistic about it.
Well, my last comment on it will be just to tie together why I brought up Deep Space Nine in the first place is that I don't think that the problem with Into Darkness is necessarily that they went down that darker path. It's that they did it in a movie. And so they have no ability to further develop that story, right? And so Star Trek needs to be on television because that's where you can really explore the types of issues that Star Trek is built for. And I think that I don't, of course, know what Simon Pegg is going to do with Star Trek Beyond. I'm not particularly optimistic that it's going to be this great revelation that I love much more than the previous two Abramsverse films. Although I think from everything that I've heard from Simon Pegg that he's going to pay a little bit more attention to bridging that gap between the new and the old than others have done up to this point. But I think that the fact that he acknowledges the need to maintain that foundation of Star Trek is really important. And I see that carrying over, although he has nothing to do with the new series. I see that on the creative side, there is that understanding by people that that is what makes Star Trek Star Trek, and that you have to make sure that you stay true to that foundation. It doesn't mean that you have to tell every story the way Gene Roddenberry would tell it. And that's what I try to explain to people who don't like Deep Space Nine and who say it's not Star Trek. You know, just because those stories are not told exactly the way Gene Roddenberry himself would have told them does not mean that they don't fit into his vision. But yeah, I think this is an important message from Simon Pegg and one that I think we'll see carried over certainly into the new series.
I think it should get our vote of confidence. I think, you know, in Star Trek Into Darkness, I felt like at a certain point, you know, someone's conscience sort of kicked in and said, really, we're going to go with a Khan story. You know, the story about how far we're willing to go to protect ourselves and you know, being faced with a potential war with the Klingons. That sounds really interesting to me. And then, oh, and let's get a Khan story in there. Someone should have said, just, no, put the brakes on that right now. You're getting too impressed with your own cleverness and don't do that. But here I'm seeing all the right words and you don't know how it's going to come to fruition because, like I said, that the elements are really complicated. There's a lot that goes into making good Star Trek and you have to weave these together in some way that makes sense. But here, this quote from Simon Pegg seems to indicate that he really does grasp something of the essence of Star Trek and all the language surrounding what we're seeing with the new Star Trek 20, what we're calling Star Trek 2017 at this point. A lot of those same terminology and words, these are phrases that indicate that people really do understand the soul of Star Trek. So I think we have every reason to be optimistic.
Yeah, I think so as well. All right, well, let's move on to the last item we have here in the news. And this one is kind of old news at this point, but there's a reason why I have it in here. So as many people know, there has been a new contest underway for Strange New Worlds. That's the anthology of short stories written by fans that started back in 1998 by Simon & Schuster, and it ran for 10 years, and then we didn't get any anymore. And in honor of the 50th anniversary, they decided to revive this contest. And it's wonderful that they did because that contest gave us some of the great writers we have now. The first person who springs to mind for me is Dayton Ward. You know, Dayton Ward got his start by winning this contest. And I think it's a wonderful way for new writers to break into Star Trek fiction and then other fan fiction as well. And it's great to see this coming back. They've chosen the winners, and I'm a little bit disappointed in the results because, Zachary, your co-host on Metatrex, Mike Morrison, wrote a wonderful entry for this contest about Enterprise, which I had the honor of editing for him. And it was largely a Hoshi story, which I love. And it's also a follow-up to the famous Enterprise episode from season 3, Damage, in which Archer has to steal a warp core from the Illyrians, and he leaves this Illyrian ship stranded. And without giving away anything about Mike's story, because we're hoping to actually bring that to everyone down the road so they can read it, it follows up on that story and talks about the repercussions of the very difficult decision that Archer made. And I'm disappointed, of course, for Mike that the story wasn't selected, because I really thought that it had a real chance of getting into the book. What's also disappointing, though, is that none of the winners have anything to do with Enterprise. And that really disappoints me, because as long as you have entries that are worthy of being included, I think in a book like this, you need to represent all five of these live action series. So there are 10 entries that won, so there will be 10 stories in the book. Naturally, you would think maybe two from each series, but even if there aren't two from Enterprise, it would have been nice if there had been one.
Yeah, likewise. I share your sentiment. I think all of us were a little disappointed for Mike. I know Mike was disappointed, of course, that his story wasn't chosen to be included. I think we were at least hoping that other Trek FM hosts and listeners submitted stories. I think we were hoping to see some representation from the network here in the batch of winners. But I think you're right. It's hard to know exactly what the balance should be. I mean, certainly, you know, there are some shows that are more popular, Next Generation and Deep Space Nine are going to be more popular, of course. So I'm not sure about the exact ratio. It does seem odd that there are no Enterprise stories at all. You know, if there were only going to be 4 stories in this collection, I can understand it. Okay, you don't have room to put everything in. But if you have 10 stories, you could at least have one story dedicated to Enterprise.
Yeah, it would be nice. And apparently there are actually 12 stories that were selected, because the first prize winners, Carrie F. Booth and James Corrigan, their stories aren't listed. And it seems that they're getting a publishing package with Archway Publishing to publish a book on another subject, according to a story on the Trek Collective. And that just seems odd to me as well.
Well, it's an odd phrase, another Star Trek subject or another subject altogether.
When I read it, I think not Star Trek, so...
It sounds like not Star Trek to me, but yeah. It's hard to tell from the phrasing. What I find exciting about this is just Star Trek has this rich history of including in a very open way submissions from fans. You know, Star Trek The Next Generation had an open submission policy, and now we've got another vehicle for fans who are creative and want to contribute to the Star Trek franchise and mythos to get their work recognized. You know, I'm not an author myself. I'm creative in other ways. I always, you know, fancy myself wanting to write a story or a novel someday, but I've never bared down to do it. But people who have the wherewithal and the tenacity to sit down and write a story, I'm pleased to see that there's some vehicle for that work to get out there and get recognized and maybe lead to even better possibilities for themselves down the road.
Yeah, definitely. So Zachary, here's the rundown of who did win. And oddly, the announcement doesn't tell you which series the stories are from, although that information does exist somewhere, because we know that there are no Enterprise stories in here. But I don't have all the breakdown myself. But the stories are by Neil Bryant, a story called Dilithium is a Girl's Best Friend. There's a story called A Christmas Carol. That's Q-A-R-O-L. So we know where that's going.
Yeah, Carol with a Q. Well, it's either a Q story or it's a Kronos with a Q story.
But there's no apostrophe in it. And the L at the end is lowercase. So
it must probably be a Q story. Yet. Yeah.
But that's by Gary Pisarcio and Frank Tagader, and I may be mispronouncing your names, and I apologize if I do. Also, The Sun Walkers by Kelly Fitzpatrick, The Seen and Unseen by Chris Chaplin, The Facade of Fate by Michael Turner, The Manhunt Pool by Nancy Debretsian, The Dreamer and the Dream by Derek Tyler Attico, and I'm pretty sure that probably involves Benny Russell, The Last Refuge by Roger McCoy, Life Among the Post-Industrial Barbarians by John Coffrin. Sounds like an original series story there. And Upon the Brink of Remembrance by Kristen McQuinn. So there we go again. We don't know exactly which series each of those talks about. We do know that there are no Enterprise stories.
Yeah, it's hard to judge a story by its title, but you know, of this batch, the two that stand out are Dilithium is a Girl's Best Friend and Life Among the Post-Industrial Barbarians. I want to read those in particular, just from the titles.
Well, and I'm interested, as a Niner, I'm interested in The Dreamer and The Dream, because if that doesn't involve Benny Russell and the storyline from Far Beyond the Stars, I would be surprised, because that is, of course, the line delivered to Sisko / Benny Russell at the end of the episode, "You are the dreamer and the dream." Mm-hmm. All right. Well, speaking of Enterprise and it not being in that book, it is in the episode today. So Zachary, let's go ahead and bring in Brandon and Dennis and talk about Silent Enemy.
Sounds great.
Most aliens in Star Trek are presented in terms that the human mind can understand. The Klingons, the Romulans, and even the Borg. We can make sense of their actions and motives, but in reality, new life that we meet out in space will have a lot less in common with us. Enterprise attempted to address this midway through its first season in Silent Enemy, which pitted our crew against beings that only CGI could create and who never spoke a word. Hence the title. Today we're going to discuss this episode, and to help us do that, we're joined by, from our music show Melodic Treks, none other than Mr. Brandon Shea Metalla, or B. Shea. Welcome, B. Shea.
Pumpkin pie, my favorite. How did you know?
Is pumpkin your favorite? And of course, everyone who's listening to the network must know your voice, Brandon, because you're on like everything these days.
Yes, there's. We've had 120 episodes of From There to Here, and I've been on 150 of them.
It seems that way, right? Because I publish those every day, and I'm like, I just have a shortcut for your name in there. All right, well, also joining us for the first time here on The Ready Room from our Fan Films show Continuing Mission, and also the man who produces Zachary's show Metatrex, it's Dennis Costello. Dennis, welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having me on, Chris.
Yeah, it's good to have you on The Ready Room for the first time. This is a place where maybe it's taken you a little bit longer to find your way here into The Ready Room by accident.
Yeah.
Amongst the hosts, because everyone ends up here from time to time. So good to have you.
I'm usually stuck in the briefing room, you know, picking up the coffee cups, sweeping up after the meetings, that kind of thing.
Is that it?
Yeah.
All right. Well, today we're going to talk about, as I said, Enterprise's Silent Enemy. And before we do that, a quick synopsis for those who haven't seen the episode or haven't seen it in a while. The Enterprise is launching a beacon that's going to help boost their communications. And it's called Echo 2, and there's already one out there called Echo 1. And soon after they release this, they are approached by a mysterious alien vessel who even the Vulcans don't know about. And these aliens, they scan the Enterprise, they don't say anything, and then they leave. Well, later they come back, and Archer wants to communicate with them, of course, and he can't. And over the course of the episode, these aliens get aggressive. The Enterprise crew has no idea why, but the Enterprise is damaged, and Archer decides that they need to head back to Earth. But the aliens have other plans. They don't want to let the Enterprise go, and they eventually board the ship. Now, behind the scenes, as all of this excitement is going on, Hoshi has been given a mission to find out what Reed's favorite food is because his birthday is coming up. And so these two play side by side. At the end of the episode, we really still don't know why the aliens had something against the Enterprise and why they were attacking the ship. But that's part of the point of the episode, as we'll find out. And spoiler alert, in the end, they do find out what Reed's favorite food is, and they have a jolly birthday party for him. All right. So let's get into the discussion here. And Bisha, if I'm not mistaken, you suggested this episode. So kick us off with your initial thoughts on Silent Enemy.
So I've just recently gone through on the From There to Here rewatch, and I've been watching Enterprise for the first time in a decade. And going through them, I really had a few episodes stand out to me, and this is one of them. It's not my favorite episode of Enterprise, but it's definitely in my top 10. Might be in my top 5 if I had to sit down and write down what my top 5 episodes were. But I really like it. I think it's really, really, really cool because usually on Star Trek, when you're presented with an alien like this, you have a resolution in the end. And I like the mystery of this. It would have been cool had the show gone on longer that we might have been able to see them again, but I think it's really cool that we didn't get a resolution and it never really came up again.
Well, they do turn up in Star Trek Online.
And apparently. The books.
Yeah. But yeah, we never saw them again on the series. But I don't know, that's part of what's great about it. It's just mysterious, right? Well, what about you, Dennis?
I'm right there with Brandon. I love this episode. I like it a lot. And it's primarily for that reason, is that the aliens are so mysterious. I wish that this happened more often. I think it's far more interesting and more mysterious. The less they explain, the more the interest goes up, the more the stakes go up. And to have them kind of bored and wander around and never actually communicate what they're after is just, I think, a fantastic plot device.
And especially since you have Hoshi there, communications officer, she is making an effort to communicate and figure things out. That's one thing I love about Enterprise is that they do handle communications in a realistic way, and she can't figure out what's going on either. So they do, it's realistic that it would remain mysterious, right? They're not going to figure this out. What about you, Zachary?
Yeah, this is, like Dennis and Brandon said, I really like this episode a lot, but it occurred to me, it's been a while since I watched Enterprise, and this is only episode 12 of the first season of Enterprise, and we learned in the very first episode, the premiere, that the Enterprise left early without being fully armed, and they were sort of ahead of schedule and weren't fully prepared, and in the first few episodes of Enterprise, I think the crew starts out somewhat naively optimistic. You know, they're starting this grand voyage. You know, Jonathan Archer greets every new contact with a smile. It's a very positive episode.
We're from Earth. Here's a map to our planet.
Exactly. And it's just a matter of time until they run into something in the galaxy that's not friendly. And this is the first real confrontation with the fact that, hey, maybe the galaxy is more of a terrifying dangerous place than they thought they might encounter when they first started the journey. So they're taking their first tenuous steps into the unknown, and it's not going to be a happy journey every step of the way.
What did you think about T'Pol's comment that it was a different time then when he asks, did the Vulcans encounter so many hostile species when they first ventured into space?
Well, it made me think, how old is T'Pol? Right?
She wasn't talking about herself. She was talking about the Vulcans. But even then, I mean, the Vulcans on a galactic timescale, the Vulcans have not been out in space that much longer than humans have.
It does kind of raise this interesting question about sort of galactic progression of sort of cultural evolution. I mean, are all these races developing technologically at about the same rate to the point where, you know, at a certain point, there's this boom of races that are now warp capable that didn't exist before? Or do they come along one at a time, or are we in the middle of a galactic space boom?
Do you know a story? There's a short story called, it's by David Brin, and it's called The Crystal Spheres.
Have you read this?
It's a really interesting story in that humans are trying to explore the galaxy and they don't find any life. They don't find any life anywhere. And they eventually are able to leave the solar system. And what we find out is that there is a crystal sphere surrounding the solar system. And that keeps communications out, right? Like you can look out, but no one can see.
Literally in a bubble. Yeah.
But no one can come in. And once they get out, they find that these crystal spheres surround all habitable worlds in the galaxy. And it's only once a civilization reaches the ability to, in Star Trek terms, be warp capable and can go explore, that they shatter their crystal sphere and they go out there. And so the humans, if I remember the story correctly, the humans finally get out there and they finally find another shattered crystal sphere, and then they find this world, but the civilization's gone. And I think the point of it there, it's similar to the Vulcans, and that's what reminded me of it, is that, you know, we kind of think that scientists always say that any aliens we encounter will be far more advanced than we are, right? Because the galaxy's so old and we must be developing late in the life of the galaxy. But this is the opposite. We developed too early, and so there was no one around. And so eventually down the road, the galaxy will flourish and there will be life everywhere and all these civilizations will be communicating, but we missed it.
See, Chris, now you've got me thinking that this crystal ball approach is the perfect answer to that pesky prime directive dilemma.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's an explanation of the Fermi paradox, which is why do we not detect any life when we scan the stars? But anyway, it's interesting, and that's what I think of when I hear T'Pol say it was a different time then. And she presents it like the Vulcans came around at this time when it was really quiet in the galaxy.
I thought it was frankly great to see something that T'Pol didn't know. You know, the Vulcans don't know about this race. T'Pol doesn't have the answer. It's right. It's kind of like the first couple seasons of Voyager when Neelix always has the answer to everything, right? Okay.
Oh, he always knows. Yeah.
He always knows. Exactly.
He's a Delta Quadrant native.
Since you mentioned a non-Star Trek work of science fiction, I think I'd like to mention one too, and that's John Scalzi's Old Man War book series. And in there, they posit that the warp capable, we'll use that term, races that are constantly bumping into each other, they cross-pollinate each other with their technology, not necessarily by trading it, but by showing what's possible. And so that once a race knows that transporters are possible, they're going to start, oh, well, we should have our own transporter, and they start looking into that instead of, say, something else. So all the races that are currently in their galaxy are all at the similar tech levels, because they're all influencing each other.
And I'm now going to chime in with my Star Trek reference into why this all makes sense for me. So
a Star Trek reference?
So
what are you talking about?
If we go back to the Next Generation episode, season 6, The Chase, if we had an alien species populate all of these alien races in our galaxy at one time, then they would all be flourishing at about the same time, because they would have had the same amount of time to develop. And you'll have the odd one here and there that'll develop new and develop late. But that's why that they're all coming up at the same time. And I think it ties right back into Star Trek.
Yeah. And I love The Chase. And that was a clever explanation for that. Now, in reality, I'm not so sure it would really work that way, even if they seeded the oceans of all these planets at the same time. But it is a really fun story. And I love the idea that it explains that we all have similarities. I mean, if you take that and you put it here on Earth, we all have something in common with one another, even though we have different cultures.
And even better, it explains the makeup limitations.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, speaking of makeup limitations, let's talk about the aliens themselves a little bit more. I mentioned in the opening that aliens in Star Trek typically are presented in a way that we can understand. So we have the Klingons, we have the Romulans, we have the Borg. Occasionally we get some unusual species, but they have human actors, right? So there's only so much they can do to make them alien. And on the commentary for Silent Enemy, it's Andre Bormanis, who was the science advisor on Star Trek for a long time, and he was a writer on Enterprise. He also wrote a number of episodes on Voyager. But it's him and Dan Curry, of course, the visual effects guy. And they mentioned that human actors will let you put stuff on their face, but they usually won't let you take stuff away. And so there's only so much you can do. So CGI was the obvious choice for this episode to really make these aliens look alien. And it's not the first time. Like, if I think on Voyager, you have species 8472, which was CGI. And that's another race where we can't really communicate with them. They really are alien to our crew. But for the most part, you don't get that in Star Trek. And so here they gave us that early in Enterprise, I think very appropriately. And the aliens are still similar enough, being humanoid, that we can comprehend them. But there's this huge rift between us and them in terms of what their motivations are. And even the things we're doing, like we don't even know what they're doing with their hands over those two crew members, right? So, Dennis, what are some of your thoughts on the aliens that we meet here?
Well, they're still bipedal creatures. And to me, that's like the least interesting. When you get to see them, it's the least, for me, it's the least interesting part of it all. Because they could have had six legs or eight legs or three legs. They could have been made of crystals. They could have had, you know, I mean, it could have been so much different. Since you're going to do CGI anyway, why not just completely unfetter the imagination and do something very alien? And it would also kind of explain why they aren't that interested in learning how to communicate with the Enterprise crew if they're that different. That's pretty much the way that my mind went. And obviously, the fact that their scans, just their scans, were so destructive and invasive, that just seems like a very bad kind of technology, because you don't want the thing you're scanning to necessarily be destroyed by your scan. That's just bad science, if you ask me.
But of course, the things that they're usually scanning, maybe it doesn't affect those things. It just affected humans. What I found interesting also was that Archer asks Reed if you got any readings from the ship. And he said no, you know, no bio signs, no signs of technology. And it reminded me that last week I was listening to an original series episode, and I can't remember the exact story at the moment, but they were scanning, they were picking up nothing, and they said that, you know, the tricorder scans what it's designed to scan. So if it's something that we don't know anything about at all, well, you're not going to get any readings, right? It's not a magic box that gives you information on anything in existence, right? You build a device to scan for information that you're expecting to get about something. And so what I like about this episode of Enterprise in that respect is that that's the point where they say, yeah, we've never encountered this before, therefore we're not going to get any readings from it. Now, of course, when their shields go down later, they do get some readings, but at least there was an effort here to show that we have no idea what we're dealing with.
That's interesting. Yeah. Mm.
I think it's really cool, the alien species and how they developed them and how they showed how they look. The coolest part that I thought seeing them was when they were shot with the phaser, and there was like a force field that you could see around them that looked like a helmet or something, like their own isolation suit or something like that. I thought that that was really cool. Like, for me, when the aliens, the first time we see them, and there's that crewman that shines the flashlight over, and the aliens walk by, I don't know about you guys, but I thought of the movie Signs, when they're, when they show that video down that alley, and I'm getting chills thinking about it again. Like, that movie creeped me out. Like, the Signs, I really love that. And when that video scene showed those aliens down that alley, like, that scared the pants off of me. And this completely evokes that for me. And, like, literally there, it gives me chills when I watch this episode and that scene pops up.
Well, it's a similar feel, right? Because in Signs, they also didn't really tell you much about the aliens, right?
Right.
The movie was about being scared of something you don't know, not about the actual aliens themselves.
Yeah. And I think it's it must be an inspiration for it. Like, I personally really like the movie Signs. I think it's really good. And I think this is definitely influenced by it.
In the commentary for Silent Enemy, they talk about the helmets, the kind of like force field bubbles. And it does remind me that in the animated series, they have the like spacesuits that are just emitted by their belt, I guess, that envelop them. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's our crew. Yeah. Any thoughts, Zachary?
Yeah, I thought this was a great attempt to finally inject a little mystery into the alien races. You know, usually, you know, encounters with an alien race, even a new alien race in Star Trek, are very formulaic. You know, we hail them and they talk back, and either they're friendly or they're aggressive, and it, you know, it's fairly predictable. In this case, we just don't get much of a communicative response, except for the Jonathan Archer, Max Headroom re-recording of Captain Archer's transmission, which I found really amusing. It actually reminded me of a TNG episode, Ensigns of Command. In that episode, there's a discussion between Counselor Troi and Captain Picard Something to the effect that it's kind of a miracle that any two species are able to communicate at all, given the linguistic barriers. And here we don't even get much of a linguistic barrier. And philosophically for me, you know, I host a Metatrack's Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. It reminds me of this issue in philosophy that was raised by a philosopher called Thomas Nagel, who had this really famous article, What Is It Like to Be a Bat? It basically, he just argued that there's this fundamental inability to put ourselves in the mindset of any other type of creature. He uses the example of a bat because it has really different sensory apparatus than our own. But I can't even imagine what it's like to be my cat on our own planet. Or, you know, even amongst humans, we don't necessarily communicate and understand each other's point of views. So it's really a miracle that we communicate in Star Trek with any alien race at all. And I think this episode just does a good job of creating some real mystery and an alien that we just fundamentally can't understand. And T'Pol makes a great point in saying not every race is going to be understandable in human terms.
Did that essay make you wish that you had sonar, Zachary?
Yeah. Well, you know, it makes me wish I was down there in Cetacean Ops with Lieutenant Commander Flipper, you know, sending some audio signals, you know, bouncing audio signals.
I thought
around.
Flipper was promoted to a full commander.
Commander Flipper, excuse me. What is it like to be Lieutenant Commander Flipper? Yeah.
You know, the ship itself felt very traditional, though. And in fact, they reused that ship later on in season 3, I think it is, for another alien race. But what would you have done to make it feel even more alien in this case? You know, I mean, Species 8472 had very unusual ship design. This felt very much like another Star Trek alien race who just happens to not want to talk to us.
It, to me, it looked a bit too green. It looked like a Romulan ship. And for the first time I watched it, I was wondering, are these the Romulans? You know, I had no idea.
Well, I had the same feeling, actually, yeah.
You know, and it also felt like something maybe out of Star Trek Nemesis. You know, it felt like maybe like the small little shuttlecraft that we see. It looked a lot like the shuttlecraft they used in Nemesis. So it looked a little too familiar. I would have tried to find something, maybe a different shape, something, you know, like, almost like the Borg cube or the Borg sphere. That was really radically alien at the time. I would have tried to find something really different.
You remember the Corbomite maneuver? Just that round ship was so alien looking, and it's just nothing but a simple sphere.
Yeah. And of course, in the remastered, it's like little domes, right?
Right.
On the sphere, which gives it an even odder look. But yeah, there are a lot of things that you could do.
But of course, by the time Enterprise rolled around, spheres are old hat, right? We had that one in the Corbomite maneuver. We had Borg spheres. So,
Borg, I guess, unless they fly at an angle, the Borg never had a diamond, you know, the Borg diamond. So maybe this could have been a diamond.
The Borg trapezoid. Yeah. How exactly would a Borg trapezoid do a barrel roll?
It's a visual to work on.
They would do it with great efficiency, Zach.
Yes, and perfection. Yeah.
Well, so these aliens attack the Enterprise. They quickly do damage. Archer realizes that he can't fight back, he can't defend his crew, and he decides to head back to Earth. So basically, he's tucking tail. He's heading home. He says, we're going to go home. Now, he's acknowledging along the way that he rushed the Enterprise out of a space dock too soon. And they're not prepared for the things that they're encountering. And they need to go back and have the phase cannons installed, for example. And it reminds you a bit of Home in the fourth season, where he's admitting to Captain Hernandez that we're not ready. And that's after everything that he encountered with the Zindi and the weapons that they had then, and then he still knows we're not ready. So here they're completely unprepared. What I took away from this myself, and you tell me your thoughts on this, is that I feel, and I think this ties into the B plot too, which we're going to talk about later with trying to find out Reed's favorite food. I feel like at this point, Archer feels guilty for putting his crew in danger and rushing the ship out of space dock because he did that to prove a point to the Vulcans that they were ready. And really, they only needed a couple of more weeks to finish preparation of the Enterprise for it to truly be launched as planned. And now he's out there and they're having trouble fulfilling their mission because they're just not properly equipped. So I feel a bit of guilt on Archer's part here.
Yes, absolutely. But before he decides to turn around, he first makes a very difficult decision, and you can see it. He's kind of warring with himself on this, whether to call the Vulcans for help.
Yeah.
And finally, you see he doesn't want to do it, but then he realizes that it's really the most responsible course of action, and so he gives the order to call the Vulcan High Command. And when they can't get through, that's when he decides to go to Earth. And I can see he's already kind of made the leap when in asking the Vulcans for help. Now he's kind of admitted, okay, we need help. And so it's not that difficult to then take the next logical step and say, we've got to go home. Yeah. And I completely see his point. Without weapons.
I feel like he would rather go home than ask the Vulcans for help, though.
Well, it's hard to say because it didn't turn out, you know, it didn't happen that way. But I mean, you could make arguments either way. You're probably correct, though. He'd rather get help from Starfleet than from the Vulcan High Command. But I think that he was correct in his decision to want to escort the Klingon to Kronos to save the Klingon's life.
Yeah, I agree.
Right?
Yeah.
But then the decision to then immediately go out after the success of that first mission to immediately then now say, okay, well, we proved we can do it. Now we're good to just go out unleashed was maybe that was the decision that was very premature. And I don't see that he's really – there's anything to be ashamed of at this point. They took their ship out. They proved the engine could work. They went and they saved the Klingon's life. They kind of – they've done a lot of good things already. Now, you know, take a step back, retrench, and then go back out.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think he did make the right decision to take the Klingon home. But then I would have come back and did final prep, do the mission right. But, you know, they had a TV show to launch, Dennis. So
yes,
they didn't have time for that.
Yes. And I also understand that you don't necessarily want the lack of weapons to be the thing that holds you back. I mean, you don't want to think that way. Like, I need a gun before I can go off and visit my neighbors, you know?
Right.
But the reality is, it's not necessarily your neighbors. You're going off into a lot of strange territory, and maybe you do need some defensive weapons.
Yeah, exactly. Vishay?
Well, I mean, you know, if he would have come back, he only had to wait until Tuesday to get these things installed.
It's always Tuesday with Starfleet, right? I mean, it's like albums are released on Tuesday, movies are released on Tuesday on DVD or Blu-ray. Components of Starships are released on Tuesday. So there you go.
You go to KFC and you get your Toonie Tuesday and, you know, it's all good. So I agree. I think that he would rather have gone home to Earth than accept from help from the Vulcans. But he did weigh, and it took him his time, and it, you know, for him to eating crow pie or whatever it is, for him to say, I would rather do that, but it's too far. I can just get a hold of the Vulcans right now. Why he made the decision to go all the way home rather than just, you know, they knew that the boys had been destroyed. The communication boys had been destroyed. Just go back far enough so you can communicate the Vulcans. That's still closer than Earth. And when the one decision that I didn't quite agree with in this episode was when Reed and Trip came up to him and said, look, we want to do this. We can do this. We're confident. And he says, no, he doesn't let them build these weapons. I question that because that's not really putting the faith in his men. His men say they can do it. Now, it goes back to that scene where Reed and Trip are talking to their workers and they say, look, they think that the Starbase can do this? No, we can do this. We can build these weapons and get them installed. And I really like that scene because it shows their confidence in their men. So I just didn't quite like that decision in the episode. And that's one of the few things that I'm not a big fan of for this episode is that he didn't put his trust in his men.
Yeah, I can see it, though, that this is a new ship. It's a much more complex design than anything that the humans have put together before. And he wants to make sure that if they have another encounter like this, everything's going to work. And so it might be like, you know, with my car these days, I'm not going to try to fix my car myself. The cars are too complicated today.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm going to take it to Nissan and have them fix it because they have all the equipment. They designed it. They know exactly what every component is doing. So I don't know, like, on a basic level, what you're saying, I agree with, put faith in your crew. So if it were Picard, for example, and there was some problem with the ship, and Geordi said, I can fix it, my team, we can do it, we'll have it done for you in 4 days, then I would say Picard should completely trust Geordi to get that done instead of going to a starbase. In this situation, I can understand why Archer's immediate reaction anyway would be, now let's go back and let the actual people who built the ship do it.
Right, but his crew, this would have been a hand-picked crew from him. He would have been able to pick the best of the best. Now, we didn't get to see him talk to everybody, but in Broken Bow, when he goes down to get Hoshi, he wants Hoshi. Because yeah. She is the best at what she does. And I absolutely believe that all of these people on the NX-01 are the best at their jobs. And for them to come to him and say, I can do this job, I don't know. I kind of understand what you're saying, had it been like a weaker crew. But with the fact that his crew is as strong as it should be, he should have that trust in his crew. For when them to say, I can do this, he should let them do it.
Do you think he lost confidence in Trip at the beginning of the episode when the upgrade wasn't as striking as he thought it would be? And Trip said, well, you know, I could paint it another color if you want.
No, I don't think so. But I think he's just questioning himself. And that's why he's making that decision to go home.
Yeah.
So now that I'm like voicing these opinions here, I think he's just questioning himself. So,
well, I kind of see it as he's already made a difficult decision and now he's being asked to reevaluate a decision he's already made. It's kind of a command thing. You know, it's like in legal terms, it's like asked and answered. I've already gone through it. I've already made my decision. This is what we're going to do. And, you know, he's not really that interested in revisiting the whole thing again until more data presents itself.
But the data is his employees saying, we are the people to fix this for you. We can do this. Have faith in us. And I mean, as I used to be a manager, and I mean, if somebody has the faith in it, you gotta be able to express that faith in them by saying, go ahead and do it. Like, that's no greater motivator than trust in your employees.
Well, do you need them to necessarily come up to you and tell you stuff you are? If he knows them that well, then he's able to evaluate them necessarily with that, because he knows their sheets. He knows their, you know, their port. What's the?
Well, and he knows Trip quite well personally. Yeah.
He knows their files upside down and backwards, and he knows what everybody's capable of, and he's able to make that decision of what should we do? Should we do it here or should we do it there? But it wasn't necessarily, I didn't mean more data. I think something else happened that caused him to reevaluate. Wasn't there another attack or something happened?
I feel like the turning point was when Trip told him if this section had gone, we would have all been killed because there were, 13 people working there, including Trip. And that's the point where, it's one thing if the hull of the ship is damaged a bit, if one little area maybe has been damaged too heavily for people to go into, but when it's a critical area and the entire ship could have been destroyed with one shot, then you realize I have to make a big decision here.
You realize how fragile you really are.
Right.
I'm trying to remember in the episode, I thought I remember Captain Archer saying something to the effect that there's other systems that need attention, you know, from folks in the Enterprise. Let's let the professionals who built the ship do that and let put you guys on these other things that need attention. I don't remember the phrase, but.
Like finding out what Reed's favorite food is?
Exactly. Yeah, the really important issues.
No, he does say that there are other systems that need attention as well, right? But they've obviously not been critical enough to need it. It's one of those things where it's like, I got a thump in my tire. Do I fix it or do I just wait? Right.
But Chris, you raise a really good point. If Captain Archer is starting to realize that just a single lucky shot could take out 13 of his best people, that's a really tenuous situation. That's not acceptable.
Right. Now, another explanation for this is that the writers halfway through season one realized that we need some weapons that actually look like Star Trek on the show because the fans are kind of losing interest in these little torpedoes that putter around. What do you think about that?
Well, the evolution of their systems is one of the things I really love. I like the fact that they start with one kind of handgun and then they get, look, these new things came in and there are phase pistols. And I understood from that as the show went on, we were going to see the tech get closer and closer to what we were familiar with. So once I kind of bought into that, I'm perfectly fine with them taking their time, you know, step by step, we'll get closer and closer.
But it happened within the period of a few months.
Yes.
So a little bit rapid. We did an episode of Warp 5 a long time ago about the evolution of the weapons technology. And again, I don't remember the episode number, off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure the title of it was Character Development in a Torpedo. And we delve more into this topic. So if anyone's interested, you can find that on Warp 5.
You're right, though. It is pretty rapid for them to go back. And I do think it's all motivated by writing and whatnot. It's like, okay, we don't have so much action in this show right now. I think we need to get some action in the show in order to keep our audience, because there was a decent amount of action in the other Star Trek series.
Yeah, yeah. Although I personally, I mean, I guess week to week, Enterprise Season 1 had less action than other series, but all the series have their quiet episodes, and sometimes they're the best episodes.
Sure.
But again, I think that fans going into Enterprise were expecting more Voyager, and they got something that was really, really different, and so that didn't really connect with them so well. But let's transition to the next topic, speaking of a lack of action, and the fact, Dennis, that you mentioned that Archer knows the files on everyone. Well, apparently he doesn't know, or at least Reed's file is really thin.
Yeah.
People don't seem to know a lot about Reed. And Reed's birthday is coming up, and so they embark on the search for pineapple. Of course, they don't know that it's pineapple when they start. They're just searching for his best food. And many fans cite the B story in this episode as an example of why Enterprise doesn't work for them. And they find it uninteresting that Hoshi's spending all this time trying to find out what Reed's favorite food is. And some people may even find the whole thing a bit belittling to her character, because here she is being given the task of just finding out what Reed's favorite food is. But I think that Hoshi addresses that in the episode herself. When Archer asks her to do this, and she's like, I'm kind of running a diagnostic right now on the communication system. This is something that needs to be done. This is really important for the mission. I really don't have time to do this. And as we've all had this experience in our jobs where a boss has asked us to do something that we feel is pointless, she has that same reaction where she's like, okay, you know, I'm going to do it, but you can tell from her expression that she thinks this is a complete waste of her time. But I would argue that this storyline is not a waste of time at all, because what you need in a drama like this is character development. And we learn a great deal about Reed through Hoshi's interactions with her parents and her sister and, you know, former friend from Starfleet. So that's the first point I'll make. And then I have another one, but let's stick with that one to begin. Dennis, you're really nodding your head. So what do you think?
Yeah, I'm not one of those Enterprise fans who didn't like this B plot. I like it a lot. And what I love about it is how really strange it makes Reed appear. I'm sure. I'm sure that in his file is a thick list of every single weapon system he's checked out on, and absolutely nothing personal. You know,
yeah.
Even his mother doesn't know what his favorite food is. That's a pretty quiet and introverted person when your own mother doesn't know what you like. There's something in this that just tickles me. And I think is more evidence of Reed's actual personality than some other things that people point to. Reed kind of has this reputation as trying to be like a ladies' man.
Yeah.
You know, but what we see firsthand is the moment that Hoshi makes what he considers even the slightest beginnings, inklings of a little bit of an overture, he just shuts it down. Boom. It's just completely cut off, no equivocation at all. It's just like, nope, that's not appropriate. Just shuts it down. And to me, that maybe this thing about him being a ladies' man, some of these stories he might tell, is kind of a mask that he wears. Yeah. And in actuality, he doesn't do any of that because he just doesn't have an interest in it. You know, when it comes down to it, he's just not going to go there.
So did he make up all of those letters in Shuttlepod 1 then?
Except for the one about Ruby. Yeah.
That one's real.
Probably none of them are probably Starfleet personnel. Maybe that's the thing, is he just will not bend regulations at all.
So I thought the situation with Reed was interesting because I think there's a danger with Reed in writing him as not necessarily the most likable person, right? And we're only 12 episodes in, so they maybe need to do a little bit of character salvation for Reed already. And for me, this really helped make Reed more of a sympathetic character in exposing how awkward he is and how closed off he really is. It sort of lays bare his inward, maybe not sensitivity, that may not be the right word, but it makes him at least sympathetic and a more likable character for me. But Dennis, you seem to imply that this made Reed to be an awfully strange character. But for me, it kind of just exposes his inner humanity, inner insecurities, perhaps.
Oh, see, that's the thing for me. Insecurities. I feel like Reed's a very insecure person. And in this episode, when they talk to his parents, you can tell that his father is very displeased with him. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that may also play into his insecurities. We've also seen how he had trouble, like when Archer invites him to the captain's quarters for a meal, mm-hmm. in a different episode earlier in the season. He's very shy about that. And even here, even before he realizes, well, he doesn't realize because she's not doing it, but he thinks that Hoshi is making a pass at him. She asks him just flat out, what's your favorite food? And he's like, it's not necessary, don't go into any trouble. And he just doesn't seem like he wants to inconvenience anyone for anything for himself. That seems to be his personality. And I think some of that maybe stems from some insecurity.
Mm-hmm. The plot line, like this plot line itself, I think it does exactly what you're saying, in that it gives a storyline for Reed. It gives a back history for Reed. It's not my favorite B plot in all of Star Trek, but it's not terrible. It doesn't take away from the show for me at all. It's kind of an odd contrast with what else is going on in the episode. We got this light with this really, really dark that are contrasting each other in this episode. I don't think that it's a belittling assignment for Hoshi myself either. I mentioned this, I did the From There to Here on this, and I said, to me, it's like Archer's going to her because he knows that she's the person who's going to be able to find this information out. And that's why he entrusts her with it. And yeah, he says, I order you to do this, but he's not really ordering her to do this. You can't order somebody to do something like this. This is completely off the record and off the books. It's just something that he wants her to do. So he's jesting with her when he says, I order you. That's an order, right? He's not being serious, and I don't take it like that at all. But he gives it to her because he believes that she is the person who's going to be able to find this information out for him.
Yeah, I guess it's a question of category here. Like, is this a case of Hoshi having to get the boss's coffee? Is it that trivial, right? Or is it like Chris, like you pointed out, everyone has had a case at work sometimes where the boss has said, we've got to do this thing, and you roll your eyes and go, this is the biggest waste of time I've ever seen, but the boss said I have to do it, so I'm going to do it. Or is this a trusted assignment that is, yeah, it's not mission critical. It's maybe awkward that it's happening at the same time as this very severe A plot that's going on at the same time. But it's an important thing that he trusts Hoshi with, like Brandon pointed out. Which is it? Yeah.
So maybe that's the thing. If we do look at something that doesn't work for people, the contrast between this and what's happening in the A plot is perhaps too disjointed.
They're very, very different from each other. And I think that's what the problem is. Had the B plot maybe had something to do with the A plot and they could have tied together at the end, or had this B plot been in with a little bit more silly of an episode, like the one where the doctor's sleeping, something like that, I think they would have worked better. I think it's because there is such a contrast between the A and the B plot line, mm-hmm. that people don't like this one so much.
Yeah, I find myself having this issue all the time with the A-B plots we see in Star Trek. Almost always, unless one of the B plots is really ridiculous and uninteresting. And for me, this B plot is in the interesting camp. I think this is an interesting human interest plot. Almost always, I would prefer those two plots to be separated into separate episodes and just have an entire episode about, this a pure human interest story about Reed's birthday. I think that's a perfectly fine, slow Star Trek story. And just separate the two plots into two different episodes. But you have this problem when you have an ensemble cast of trying to have something for everyone to do, and it forces this sometimes artificial juxtaposition of the A plot and the B plot.
So in Zachary's world, there are 14 seasons of The Next Generation, maybe 21 seasons of DS9, because there were often C plots in those episodes, and 14 seasons of Voyager.
I love it. You're in charge of the new show, Zach.
I like the idea of 7 full seasons of B-plots.
Well, I proposed this idea on the Ready Room before of having Star Trek B-sides where you get, like when they used to do the VHS tapes, it had one episode on a tape. But if you had something with 2 episodes, like an LP, and you've got the episode we all know on the front side, and then on the B side, you've got either the B plot or you've got just another take on the episode or something along those lines.
So what is the best candidate from Enterprise of a B episode, a B side?
For this?
Yeah, in general. Does Enterprise have a good candidate for a B?
Well, this could be
B
one right
already?
Here, for sure. Silent Enemy.
Mm-hmm. What, the search for... birthday cake or the search for favorite food? I don't think so.
Pineapple birthday cake.
Pineapple cake. I gotta say, though.
This could air on the Food Network.
Where did the pineapples come from? I refuse to believe they just happened to have boxes of pineapples on the Enterprise.
No, so Andre Bermanis said in the writer's room that they were just trying to come up with an idea of what the problem might be to overcome. And they said, okay, well, Reed has an allergy to something. And he takes medication to deal with that allergy. And so that's going to lead them down the trail. And Brannon just threw out pineapple. And so Andre said that he went and started researching pineapple to find out, is there something here that we can work with? And then he found out that, yes, there is this thing in pineapple that does cause problems. And in fact, it also exists in a few other foods like grapefruit. And Andre said that he personally takes Lipitor for his arteries, and he cannot eat pineapple or grapefruit because of this. Is it bromine? Is that right?
I thought it was bromide. But
Bromance.
Right. Bromide sounds about right.
Yeah. Because of this bromide or whatever it's called, because it actually affects the drug. And so that's a real thing. But the reason for pineapple is that Brannon just threw out pineapple as the fruit, and then they took it from there.
There's one thing that I got to say about this. For all the people that say they've got an issue with belittling Hoshi in this, I'm a shop steward. I work in a union environment. And the fact that nobody else was invited to this birthday party and nobody else has a birthday party in the Enterprise would not fly in union, because you got to treat everybody fairly. We just took a whole shop steward course on making sure you include everybody in that. And the fact there was 3 people or 4 people eating that cake, oh, that would not fly in my office.
That's a lot of cake, you know. For each person.
And what I mean by belittling Hoshi is some people will see it as, well, okay, we're going to give the woman on the crew the job of finding out what Reed's favorite food is, even though she has a talent that she could use for something else. And I don't think that that was the intention of Archer here. And I think that reading the story that way is misreading the intention of the writers and misreading the intention of Archer.
It's perhaps
as the captain as well.
It's perhaps a side effect of not having enough women on the crew in general, so that it's harder to kind of share that among genders.
But you can also look at, in order to find out that information, especially in order to talk to his parents and his sister and other people, you need to be able to communicate very well. She's the communicator on the ship, right? That's her talent.
Plus, there's the fact that she's also very into food and good cook, and who better to into that than somebody who kind of cares about that?
Exactly.
That episode when her soup is too salty, she's like, ah!
That's right. Well, she was under an influence, right?
Make sure we don't forget the character development we get for Trip in this episode. We learn that he likes pan-fried catfish.
Yes. This is the first time that's mentioned, I guess, right?
Yes.
And I think so.
Definitely becomes a thing after that. I love, speaking of the search for food here, there's this moment in sickbay, which I mentioned on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
Where Hoshi goes in and talks to Phlox, and it's like John Billingsley turns into Jerry Seinfeld. And Hoshi asks him, any idea what his favorite food might be? And Phlox says, ah, the birthday dinner. Well, the man loves a good breakfast. And then Hoshi's like, what? Eggs. I've seen him eat a lot of eggs. And then it goes on and on. And then he says, as like an afterthought, oh, and he enjoys pancakes on occasion. He has the odd habit of spreading peanut butter on them. Sausage, that's another favorite. Bacon, too, come to think of it. And it's like Jerry Seinfeld just rambling things off, and the fact that Jerry can never get into a relationship because the women he dates always do something that he finds odd.
Right.
Like perhaps here spreading peanut butter on pancakes.
Right, right.
I got to say, I love Phlox in this episode, though, because at first, when Hoshi first comes into sickbay, you know, he's a little distant from this idea of the birthday party. He knows about the dinner. Yeah, he's, you know, he's giving some suggestions. But eventually, he sort of opens up and he goes, you know, I kind of have the keys to the back door here. And I've got Reed's right. medical records. And you can get this little twinkle in his eye, like, I've got the answer you're looking for.
Well, it gave him a problem that he could solve from a medical standpoint, right?
Yes.
Yes. So that worked well for him.
What if Reed at the end, though, would have been like, oh, pineapple, I don't like pineapple. But what I like grapefruit cake.
Well, if he says, I love fish, right? Because Hoshi was told that I think he hates fish. But of course, we know from Shuttle Pod 1 that he chose sea bass as the rations that he wanted to eat. So that, clearly he doesn't hate fish.
Delivery of that line by that guy where he's just like, oh, it was the waitress. Oh, yeah, yeah. He hates fish. Just the delivery of that line is just priceless.
You know they were drinking buddies, right?
Right, yeah.
That scene where Malcolm thinks Hoshi's asking him out, did you notice the crewman sitting off to the side kind of overhearing this, you know, eavesdropping on this conversation? Got to go back and watch it. There's this crewman sitting right next to them hearing this whole conversation. And as Reed realizes that he gets it wrong, you know, this crewman is looking at him like, oh my God, what just happened here?
That's funny. I haven't noticed that. I'll have to go back and check that. One thing that I also saw, which I don't know if it was intentionally done or not, but if they were doing it to give some authenticity to Hoshi as being Japanese, when she is a little bit embarrassed by it and she laughs, she puts her hand in front of her mouth. That's something that all Japanese women do. When they laugh, they will put their hand in front of their mouth. Not like, huh. It's not like American women, like full on laugh out loud, you know? So I thought that was interesting, and I don't know if it was put in there intentionally or not, but, or maybe Linda Park does that herself. Yeah, I don't know, but
that sounds like something an actress would bring to a performance. Yeah.
So now the one question for you guys, then, would it have been funnier if he actually accepted the advances that he thought were coming at him?
That would have been funny. And then how does she react to that?
Because she's just trying to get his food and he'd be like, oh, I'll come to your quarters and have you make me a meal. What?
Well, he probably thinks back to this moment when he realizes that, you know, he has not paired off with anyone. And he's probably thinking, I should have taken Hoshi up on that hot plate thing.
When the Reed line comes to an unceremonious end. Yeah. I think it would have been an awkward scene, though, to have Reed thinking he's on a date and Hoshi's made him dinner and the light bulb goes on. She realizes what's going on. That would have been more awkward than what we saw, I think.
Yeah, that would have been awkward. Yeah. So the last point I want to make on this before we go on to the final item on our outline is just the fact that I think the other thing that this B plot shows is that Archer really cares about his crew because he's concerned about the fact that he doesn't know much about Reed. Well, initially, he just wants to do something special for Reed for his birthday. And then after talking to his parents and finding out that Reed seems to be very introverted, he becomes a little bit concerned that they don't know anything about Reed and he wants to know more about his crew members. And again, he wants to do something that is going to make Reed happy and give him a good birthday. And I just think that shows a bit of the humanity of the show. I mean, the point of Enterprise is that they were trying to make a show that's closer to where we are, that the people are closer to us than the Starfleet officers that we see in the 23rd and 24th century. And this is exactly something that we would do in an office, right? We want to have a birthday party for a colleague and we want to find out what their favorite food is. And we don't want them to know that we're going to do it because we want it to be a surprise. So they may be in space, but this feels like us.
But I guess I don't understand the criticism of this. I mean, even in The Next Generation, we had some ridiculousness like Captain Picard Day and things like that. I mean, you know, this has been part of Star Trek all along. So,
but I think that
not unique to Enterprise.
I think the only complaint is that people take the plot of it's given to Hoshi, who doesn't have a lot, and whatnot. And in Captain Picard Day, nobody's given a task like that. Like, I agree. I think there's more.
Well, the kids are. The kids have to make, like, mashed potato sculptures of Picard's head or stuff like that, right?
That one looked like
We did have Counselor Troy showing Captain Picard the different options. Like, you have to pick one of these. And
yeah.
It was her assignment.
There you go. Yeah, why did Troy have to do that? She's not a teacher.
Right. Well, neither is Keiko O'Brien, but she opened a school on the station. So All right. Well, we're getting close to an hour, and I do want to talk about one more thing before we get to our final thoughts, and that's just the direction, the visuals, and the sound of this episode. This is the final Star Trek episode for Winrich Kolbe, who is, of course, a prolific director on Star Trek. He helmed so many episodes. And we also get this, we get a lot of contrast in this episode as we move through different parts of the ship and the story. The bridge, of course, looks normal at the beginning. Along the way, we get a lot of shadows and dark, almost like film noir-inspired scenes in the mess hall. We get this very haunted house vibe when the aliens come aboard the Enterprise. And we talked a little bit, you had a great point earlier, Bichet, about the feeling of signs, right? And then also when we're in Phlox's sick bay, we have sort of the brighter look again. And then also there are some nice musical cues that we picked up. There's a composer, Velton Ray Bunch. I think, and Brandon, you can tell me for sure, this may have been his first episode.
You're right.
Of scoring for Enterprise. And I thought he did a nice job of incorporating the Archer theme that we hear at the end credits, actually, of Enterprise, into some key moments in this episode with the rest of his score. So why don't we start, though, like talking about visuals, direction a little bit. And Dennis, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I generally like the visuals in Enterprise. I like them a lot. They're my favorite. It has my favorite look of all of the series, even including, of course, the original series, because it's now so dated in its look. But the darkness in that section where the aliens board, I absolutely love it when the lights go down and they're searching and you've got the flashlight beams and you've got those two guys. And I don't know, this doesn't necessarily talk about cinematography or camera work. But when you see two extras that you've never seen before, doesn't that don't you immediately know it's not going to turn out well for these guys?
That's right.
Especially when they see something, you know, mysterious that raises kind of the hairs on the back of your neck. Those two aliens cross by, and then they're like, "What was that? Let's go look." You're like, no. Don't
it's
go
like the
look.
Engineering crewman in First Contact who climbs into the Jefferies tube to find out what that noise is, right?
Right. Yes. I want to shout at these guys. Wait till you have a name. Right. You know, don't go look yet. But I thought the episode was, and maybe part of the reason why people object to the B story is that it tends to suck the energy out of what is otherwise a tense storyline with the aliens. You know, here you are. What are these? This huge mystery. Who are these aliens? What do they want? What, you know, what's the story there? And then all of a sudden, oh, what's the favorite food? You're like, ah, you know. So in another episode, as Zach was saying, maybe that B plot works better. So it's a pacing thing, perhaps. Maybe it's an editing thing. But really, you know, it would have been hard to, I think, combine this plot of the silent enemy with just about any other kind of B story.
Brendan, tell us a little bit about the music.
So Velton Ray Bunch actually got the job on Enterprise through Scott Bakula because Velton Ray Bunch had composed for Quantum Leap in the past. Yeah. So they had known each other from there. So this was his first score for it. And if you listen to it, I don't know if you guys have noticed or not, but to me, it totally sounds like the score for The Thing from 1982. There's that thumping electronic. And I sent a message to Velton Ray Bunch to ask him about this. And he's like, "I've never seen The Thing." So,
well, that might, you know, call to some instinctual things that our minds associate with certain situations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there are certain motifs that naturally come up.
Yeah, it really fits it. It's a moody score. There are a few tracks of it that are available on the La La Land 4-CD release for Enterprise. There are a few tracks from this episode in there. But it's some great stuff. And Velton Ray Bunch, I think he did 13 episodes for Enterprise.
Zachary, any thoughts on the creative side here?
Well, I was honestly a little surprised when you put this on the show notes for today, because it's not something that stood out to me immediately in the episode. I had to go back and rewatch it to get a feel for this. now that I've thought about it a little bit, I'm still not really convinced of which approach it is. On the one hand, it speaks to the disjointedness of the A plot and the B plot, you know, the radical difference in tone and music and visual style and the lighting and whatnot. And there is a stark contrast there. On the other hand, what you have inside this episode are a series of what could be interpreted as real small sort of visual vignettes, right? Yeah. You've got this scary sort of action horror sequence. You've got the lighthearted comedy in the mess hall and so on and so forth. Even an inspirational speech from Trip and Reed together about building these phase cannons. So, you know, each one of these is its own little vignette and they're filmed as such. So there isn't a lot of unity amongst those scenes, but if each of those is supposed to be a self-contained little story, it makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, good point. Well, let's wrap up here as we pass an hour with our final thoughts and our rating on the episode. So, Bishay, why don't you kick us off?
Like I said at the beginning, this is in my top 10 for sure for Enterprise episodes. It's probably my favorite from season one. I probably wouldn't be stretching too far if I said it was a top 5 episode. The disjointedness of the A plot and the B plot, it doesn't bother me that much because they are still both very enjoyable. I definitely prefer the A plot, and this is why I really like this episode, because it's dark, it's moody, it's creepy. You'll hear me use those words all the time when describing my favorite episodes of Star Trek, because that's the aspect of the science fiction that I like. These odd things that we don't understand, these really creepy things. And this episode has it in spades, hands down. So I would recommend it for anybody to see it. Go rewatch it if you haven't watched it in a while. And I'm going to give this 4.5 slices of pumpkin pie.
Sticking with that pumpkin pie, aren't you?
I'm not a big fan of pineapple.
Well, you're allergic to it, right?
I'm allergic to it.
All right. How about you, Dennis?
Well, I guess, you know, I'm right there with Brandon once again. I happen to like a lot more, perhaps. I don't want to assume anything, but I happen to like a lot of episodes from season one of Enterprise. So this might be farther down on my list. Maybe it doesn't make top 5 simply because I have so many favorites in this season. But I do love it a lot. And it's primarily for the alien. And I don't dislike the B plot at all either. So there's that. So there's very little negative for me about this. I guess if I was going to give this a rating, I'd have to give it a rating of 4 rings of pineapple.
Great. Is that in juice?
In juice, yes.
In juice, okay.
Au jus.
Okay. Got to get that from our Canadian here. All right. Zachary, how about you?
Yeah. You know, I mentioned before that I really do like the B plot. I'm not one of the B plot haters in this episode, but for me, the issue that speaks to me the most is this complex issue about tucking tail and running. You know, I mean, anytime, if you look back at the history of exploration, a picture of any of these explorers like Lewis and Clark, you know, they all have to decide, what are we taking with us? And is this journey really worth the risk? And when they're some portion of the way along the journey, when the journey gets hard, do they have to turn back or do they keep going? This is a really classic theme about exploration. And it really does kind of speak to the depth of Captain Archer. You know, Captain Archer has to weigh very seriously, you know, if we keep beefing up the Enterprise, you know, to protect ourselves. He wants to protect his ship. He wants to protect his crew. What message does that send, a well-armed ship going out into the galaxy, when the Enterprise is supposed to be a ship of peace and a ship of exploration? And Captain Archer wrestles with that issue inside this episode. He has to balance the ideals of Starfleet and what will become the Federation in going out to explore with the pragmatic reality of the dangerous galaxy that he's stepping out and venturing into. And I love the way this episode deals with those issues. So for me, I think this is a really great sort of distinguishing characteristic of Enterprise as a show, especially early on in the first season, halfway through the first season or so. One of my favorite Enterprise episodes for sure. So for me, I'm going to have to give this 9 out of 10 dinner invitations from Hoshi.
I hope you don't misinterpret that invitation. Zachary.
It's far too late for that.
Right. Well, my final thoughts echo, I guess, a lot of what you just said, Zachary, in that I think this is a nice turning point for Enterprise. Well, a turning point for the crew and what their expectations were going out into space and then what the reality is. And it has a good balance between them being a lot like us. They're going about their life on the ship. They're kind of a family. But they're realizing how dangerous this exploration is, and they're realizing that they're not quite where they need to be, and so they're starting to make some adjustments for that. And it's been interesting talking about the B-plot today, because I think that we were able to get to a point where we do see how, even if we like this B-plot story by itself, perhaps this episode wasn't the best place for it to appear. And so that can create some problem for some viewers. So that was good to see. One thing that I didn't mention because it didn't come up that I love about this episode is I love that Porthos walks around the ship with Archer so much, because that's, again, this idea of them being closer to our time, that here's a man, he's got a dog, dog follows him around, they're buddies. He might be the captain of a starship, they might be out in space somewhere, but they're just walking down the hallway together.
Yeah, he's got his long sleeve t-shirt on and his dog behind him, yeah.
So I love having Porthos on this show, because along with like the baseball caps that they wear when they go down to planets, it just feels, you can see yourself there, right? You can see yourself out there exploring. And I think that's great. But I really enjoy this episode. I'm glad that, you know, it's not a Hoshi episode per se, but Hoshi gets a lot to do. And I always like episodes that feature Hoshi. I think she was a very underused character that played a really important role in early space exploration of this type. And I think Linda Park does a really good job with the role, and they should have used her more often. So this is a good episode if you want to see Linda get to do something on the screen. So I'm going to give this episode 8 octopus arms with the suckers on them. Which apparently Reed told his sister that he likes to eat, but he may have been pulling her leg.
Is that 8 out of 8?
That's right, it's 8 out of 8, I guess. All right. We don't know about a space octopus, though, Brandon. I mean, a space octopus could have 16 legs. We have no idea.
Well, then your rating just went way down.
I know. I don't. I'm gonna say it's an Earth octopus then.
I feel like a space octopus would have like 8 batches of 8.
Yeah. See, this is what happens when we try to make sense of the rating system on the Ready Room. Just, it's better not to ask questions.
True.
Just don't ask what it means. All right. Well, before we go, thanks for joining us today, Brandon and Dennis. Before we go, tell everyone where they can find you around the interwebs and the network. Dennis.
Well, on the network, I'm the host of Continuing Mission, Trek FM's podcast about Star Trek fan projects of all varieties. And on the internet, you can probably best find me on Trek FM's listeners only Facebook group called The Babel Conference. I'm always there sticking in my 2 cents and, you know, misspelling things as I like to do.
That happens a lot on Facebook. All right. Thank you, Dennis. And Bichet.
Well, when I'm not freaking out at aliens walking by me and eating pumpkin pie, you can find me here on the network with Melodic Treks, which is our show all about music. And I actually just did an episode where I played 6 different versions of the Enterprise theme song. It was a fun little episode, and I'm actually quite surprised at the amount of positive feedback I've gotten from that episode. It's a fun little episode. It's only 30 minutes long, but I like to take a look at the history and the conception of that song, and we look at Russell Watson and Diane Warren, who wrote the song. So that's a fun one. Check it out. You can find me here on the network with many episodes of From There to Here, which is our 50th anniversary rewatch project. And every once in a while, I'm scattered around on a few episodes here and there with a few of our other shows. You can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella, and also on the Babel Conference quite frequently. Oh, and on the Trek FM now, I'm doing the Trek FM quote of the day.
Oh, yeah. I saw that. You've been doing that. Yeah.
So watch for that. That's me.
Very good. And Mutala, M-U-T-A-L-A, for those wondering how to spell that. Excellent. All right. Well, thanks for joining us, guys.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Chris, it was great talking about Silent Enemy here from Enterprise with Dennis and Brandon tonight.
Yeah, it was fun. It was an interesting story. It's one that I actually had watched not too long ago because I had been doing an Enterprise rewatch, but I didn't remember all the details of it, And I actually watched it 3 times before this show, mainly because I wanted to also listen to the commentary track, which I mentioned with Andre Bormanis and Dan Curry. That's one of the great things about the Enterprise Blu-rays is that we actually have commentary tracks for some of the episodes, although sadly not all. And I love hearing the thought process behind the making of the episode and what was going through their heads when they decided to send Hoshi on the search for Pineapple.
Well, you know, every time I get a chance to talk about Enterprise with other Trek FM hosts, I'm always disappointed in myself that I don't give Enterprise more of a fair chance. I mean, it's not that I dislike the show. I just immediately go to other shows. Voyager's my favorite series. You know, I'll go to The Next Generation. I became a fan of Deep Space Nine later in life. But even still now, despite the fact that I've learned to appreciate Enterprise, and I enjoy it much more than I used to. I've had to learn to appreciate it. I don't go to it by default. And there's so much rich material there, especially this topic we talked about Captain Archer having to decide what the risks are in continuing to push forward with his mission, or to tuck tail and run back, and these deep issues about how he wants to present himself as commander of a ship of peace and exploration, or a well-armed ship that could be interpreted as a ship of war. These are really deep, great issues, and I feel like I'm disappointed in myself that I don't give Enterprise more of a fair chance sometimes.
Yeah, I think that's the case for a lot of people. And when I put it in and I watch an Enterprise episode, I immediately think, wow, I really like this show. It's unique within Star Trek, and I should be watching more episodes of this. So hopefully we'll inspire listeners to go watch this episode as well as more Enterprise. But Silent Enemy isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network recently. So here's a quick look at some of the topics that you'll hear elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, the 602 Club.
You know, I think part of it has to do with... Yeah, and that is a good point. You know, you could draw maybe more of a parallel between Roger Moore and Cary Grant than you could Cary Grant and Sean Connery.
Literary Treks.
One of my issues I had with this whole series is as a graphic novel, is I was expecting one continuous story. And each chapter was an issue that was separate from each other.
Meta Treks.
Wait, your idea of Rise is like Fairhaven.
Yeah, I like the quiet, peaceful. I mean, every time I watch one of those,
I don't want to see those Fairhaven characters in bikinis. I'm sorry.
Women at Warp.
The only way that she can get through the trauma is remembering what her real story is, and that's getting this puppy home and taking care of it.
I wish that Captain Jeremy Nelson said, "Let's get this puppy home."
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these episodes and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find these shows everywhere that you get your podcasts. Of course, you can find us on iTunes, where we're a featured content provider with Apple. You can also find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, BlackBerry, SoundCloud, and also a new development since the last time we recorded an episode of The Ready Room is that Google finally launched the podcast section in the Google Play Music app. Now, this is something that they've been planning for a long time, and we registered all of our shows, I don't know, maybe like 4 or 5 months ago at least. And we've had it all set up for a long time, but it wasn't available. And Google finally did launch it on, I believe it was the 18th of April. So if you're an Android user and you're in the United States, because it's only available in the US right now, get your Google Play Music app and search for podcasts, and you should find most of the Trek FM shows in there. And hopefully this is going to make it easier for Android users to consume not only our podcasts, but podcasts in general, because that's just, it's been a problem on the Android side. You know, podcast consumption is about 6 to 1 iOS. Those are the metrics month after month after month, and not just for our shows, but podcasts in general. And a lot of that stems from the fact that Google just hasn't supported podcasts. And now that they are, hopefully a lot more people will be able to enjoy the Star Trek discussion that we have here on the network. Now, also, if you don't use a podcast app, although I highly recommend that you do use one, that's the best way to consume podcasts. You can get the shows on our website. If you just go to the show pages, there's a streaming player there. You can listen on the site, or you can download the MP3 file and just listen in the traditional way, you know, drop it into iTunes, play it like it's an audio track from an album or something. You can do that as well. Now, if you have feedback on today's show, we would love to hear your thoughts on Silent Enemy, Enterprise, the things we talked about in news, anything you want to discuss with us. You can send us feedback in a variety of ways. If you want to have a conversation with us and other listeners, the best place to do that is in the Babel Conference, our closed listeners group on Facebook. Zachary, take a second here and tell everyone about the Babel Conference.
Yeah, the Babel Conference is Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. If you just go to Facebook and go to the search bar and type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, it'll come right up. It's a closed group just for Trek FM listeners, so hit the join button and someone will let you right in. I think we take a lot of pride here at Trek FM on the Babel Conference, making sure that we keep the discussions that happen there civil and pleasant and respectful, and it's a great place to connect with fellow Trek FM listeners and fellow Star Trek fans and talk about anything in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find discussions on every single one of our podcast episodes and any topic you happen to find interesting. So if you haven't joined us in the Babel Conference, please do that. It's a great place to connect with other Trek FM listeners.
Yeah, it's a great place. We post our shows on Facebook, obviously, when we publish them. And then we share those posts from our main page on Facebook, which is facebook.com/TrekFM, over into the Babel Conference. And so usually right away, some listeners will begin a conversation about the episode. So it's really a way to extend the conversation beyond what you're listening to on the podcast. So join us over there. Now, if you're not on Facebook, you can also find us on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. And you can send us email through the website. If you go to trek.fm/contact, there's a form there. Just choose to send to a show and choose the ready room, and that'll come to me by email. And also, you can send me a voicemail if you like at speakpipe.com/trekfm. Now, episode 200 is coming up. I've actually already recorded episode 200. It's a special episode. If you would like to send me some thoughts on the ready room, you can do that, and I'll try to incorporate them into the final cut. Again, email trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to the ready room or speakpipe.com/trekfm for voicemail. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on the past 199 episodes, 5 years of the ready room. I'd also like to take a quick moment and thank my associate producers here on the ready room, Renee Roberts, Sam Piasek, and some guy named Zachary Frueling. I really appreciate the help.
You got to watch out for that guy.
You got to watch out for him for sure. Yeah, I really appreciate all the support, Zachary, from you, from Sam, and from Renee, helping get the show out there to everyone, making it possible for me to produce the show by supporting the network through Patreon. And if you would like to support us, you can do that as well. Patreon.com/TrekFM is the URL. You can find out everything that you need to know over there, including all the great perks that we have for you. We have a special website called Patron Zone at patron.zone, where we do early show releases. We have ringtones and artwork and avatars and sometimes video clips and all sorts of things that we put up there. Just special little bonus things for our listeners who help us pay for the high cost of running the network. So if you can support us, we would love to have you there. Patreon.com/TrekFM is the URL. And again, a big thank you to Renee Roberts, Sam Piasek, and that guy, Zachary Frueling, for supporting us through Patreon. All right. Well, Zachary, when you're not roaming the corridors of the Enterprise trying to find out what is the favorite food of the weird aliens who have boarded the ship, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me occasionally here on the Ready Room, and mainly you can find me as one half of Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy, MetaTrex, along with my co-host of that show, Mike Morrison. You can also find me in the Babel Conference if you want to talk in particular Star Trek and philosophy with me, but Star Trek in general. Be sure to find me in the Babel Conference that I described a little while ago. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, at Zachary Frueling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Frueling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G.
I'm glad you spelled that for everyone.
I've heard all different spellings over the years.
People be looking you up. Frueling, F-R-O-O-L-I-N-G.
I've heard it all.
Yeah. All right. Well, if you want to find me, you can find me around, of course, in the Babel Conference. I am there. You can also find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. That's also my name on Facebook and pretty much everywhere. Here on the network, you can find me doing The Orb with Matthew Rushing, which is our show that's dedicated to Deep Space Nine. And I also do Hyperchannel, which is our short news show. Outside of the network, you can find my writing about Star Trek on the official website at StarTrek.com. Just search for my name, C. Brian Jones, the letter C, and then a space, and then Brian with a Y. And then, of course, the last name Jones, and my articles should come up that way. It can be hard to find things otherwise. You kind of have to search for them as time goes on. But yeah, I do write as well as talk on mic. My actual real job in life is I'm an editor and a writer, so I do write quite a lot, even though I talk on Trek FM. So check those out if you want to hear some of my other thoughts on the world of Star Trek. Well, Zachary, that's it for today's episode, so I'm going to let you go. I'm going to wander down to Hoshi's quarters because she said she's got that hot plate, and I'd really like to have some yakiniku.
Well, don't miss that for sure. Well, for me, I'm going to turn around and head on home for a quick systems upgrade. In the meantime, it's time to stick a pineapple in it because the ready room is done.
Moving on to the next story, this is about Star Trek Beyond. I haven't been able to do that in a while either.
Was I supposed to do that? I missed my cue, sorry.
So, you know, I do that on the Ready Room. And now in the Babel Conference and elsewhere, I've got people like writing Beyond in all capital letters when they send me messages and stuff.
Once in a while, we do it on Meta Treks because Meta means Beyond. So we go, Meta! You know.
Oh, okay. So we talked a little bit about this on past shows. Of course, we've talked about...